Chapter 39. An Embassy from the Alka Alon. A week after I had conquered a rump barony, things were slowly getting back to normal. Penny had already started sneering at my castle. She was likewise unimpressed with Sevendor as a whole. Her family's estates dwarfed even greater Sevendor, as the extent of my domain was now being called, and her new manor, Fair Oaks, in the capital, was far more grand and luxurious, her servants more polished and better trained, and, let's face it, it just smelled better. Mavone was less rude about it. Sevendor was just another castle, after all, and he'd seen his share. He'd moved on back to Wenshar as soon as he could arrange passage, thanking me for a refreshing diversion. I suppose conquering a half-dozen domains for a friend on his vacation counts as fun for a man like Mavone. He did promise to return for the magic fair, on his way back to the front, however. Personally, I think he liked Sevendor. Sarakim and Planus stayed longer. Sarakim enjoyed being under the eye of the spellmonger, and went out of his way to ingratiate himself to me by holding regular classes at the Butts for my people, teaching them the finer points of the archer's craft. I didn't mind. The shot that wounded Ganyalin proved that the man knew his business. Planus asked permission to stay through the approaching magical fair, and I could hardly refuse him. He put up with the rugged, rustic castle living with more grace than his cousin, and both of them were fascinated by the feel of magic in the presence of so much snowstone. "It's amazing stuff, Min," Penny told me one morning, remarking about the feeling she awoke with after she'd slept in Sevendor Castle. "To be surrounded in it is like being surrounded by magic, just begging to be manifested. No wonder the tree folk want some. The samples you sent me were impressive, but—" She shook her head. "I can't imagine anyone with talent not thriving here. This would be an ideal place for a magical school," she proposed. "Something like that," I agreed. We were standing in my laboratory, the first time I had been able to ditch politics for a while and focus on magic. "I have plans to excavate the mountain and build a far larger fortress, large enough for an academy of sorts." "A fortress? You just got rid of your worst enemy," she said, confused. "Why do you need a bigger castle?"
"Because I haven't defeated my worst enemy. He's still out there, with a horde of 1 million goblins, and he's not going to go away on his own. Sevendor Castle was a decent defense against other local lords. The new Sevendor Castle should be able to withstand a siege of hundreds of thousands of goblins."
"That will take years," she complained, "and to waste snowstone on it seems lavish," she said diplomatically.
"I hope I have years," I replied. "You see how fast things are moving in Gilmora. They haven't even gotten their invasion organized, and were already half beaten. It will take tremendous effort to keep them back, and still more to throw them out of Gilmora. We're going to slow the Gavani down, but they won't be defeated easily, nor will they hesitate to attack me wherever I am. So building a whopping big castle might seem like a waste, but I see it as insurance against the inevitable future bad times."
"You're the spellmonger," she shrugged.
She was saying that more and more when we disagreed, but only when she didn't see it as an important enough point to argue about.
"I suppose I should stay for the magical fair, too, since missing it would be a social disaster."
"I'm planning a ball, sort of," I said. "Nothing fancy, but a celebration of the champion is in order." She nodded thoughtfully.
"That's good to know, since I have nothing to wear," she said in defiance of the large baggage train she had arrived with. "But I'm speaking of the spellmonger's first social event of the new kingdom. I can't miss that, nor can I miss the fair itself. I have an extensive shopping list, and I'm hoping I can find some things your man Bannermore has told me will be there."
"He's the one to know," I agreed. Bannermore had taken his duties as spell warden seriously, and had worked on the fair right through the siege. I had left the details almost entirely to him, and he was accomplishing a lot toward a successful event. "But that also means you'll be here for Sir Kay's wedding next week," I pointed out, "right at the end of harvest."
"Oh, goddess spare me from an overabundance of enthusiasm," she said ruefully.
She had yet to forgive Sir Kay for imprisoning her in a dungeon during the siege of Bovol Castle, and had nearly objected when I wanted to hire him as castellan.
"You remember him at your wedding? The man seems far too dour to get married.
You'll be surprised how much Sir Kay has changed, once he got the taste of honey on his lips, I assured her. He's due back from his estate today or tomorrow. He had wanted to ride to see to his lady's safety as soon as he was able, and I'd granted him a few days' leave after he helped get my new vassals organized. He still worked for Kusi. I wouldn't hire the man to clean my chamber pot. Luckily, you don't have to, and I think you'll like his wife. If Penny was discouraging about the impending nuptials, Alio was in a tizzy. She had been pregnant and in exile before our wedding in Tauri, and as much as my parents had tried to make her feel at home, she had missed the planning all women seemed to have about their maiden moon. While Lady Estret was far from a maiden, Alia saw this as an important alliance and wanted to celebrate it appropriately. She said as much that evening as we crawled into bed together. The late summer night was warm, but my snowstone castle reflected a lot of the heat away, and a helpful mountain breeze through the open window kept it from being unbearable. "We can't have Baron Arathaniel arrive for a peasant's wedding," she had declared as she tugged on her thin cotton nightgown. She had lost a lot of her curves since Minalion was born, save where they enticed me the most. It was hard to concentrate on what she was saying, with two big distractions compelling my eye. "Pay attention. Ulmeg says he can get some late-blooming flowers for the altar, but the wine Bannamor chose is abysmal. Sire Kay deserves more than that. Sevendor deserves more than that. We have our reputation to uphold, and I will not let ill be said of our hospitality. This is the first function we've hosted, and there are many eyes on how successful it is." "We kept the guest list small on purpose," I reminded her. "Just Estret's family, Baron Arathaniel's retinue. He's Kay's liege, he has to be there. Sire Sigilyn's party, we can't exclude him. We just conquered half of Barony together. The priestesses, Landbrother Myson, and the yeomanry. And at least 1,000 Bovali," she reminded me, "all of whom see this as much a celebration of our liberation as a wedding. All of your new subject lords, who will be lining up to kiss your arse." "They should. I just conquered them. And since everyone is here, I'll have to name a new vassal to that vacant fief, Northwood." Sire Vray of Northwood had been a crony of Gimbal's, and had refused to swear fealty to me, joining his embittered former liege in exile in East Flaria. That was just as well, as he was so hated among his people that I probably would have had to remove him from his fief anyway. As it was, Northwood was going to need some assistance and some wise guidance to prosper again. A generation of penurious taxation and rampant corruption had left the people as bitter as the original Sevendori had been. "Who have you decided to name?" she asked carefully. She was still very wary of my prerogatives as Mage Lord, and did not want to seem as if she was unduly influencing me. "Why, who would you see in the post?"
"Whomever my lord decides," she said sweetly.
"Well, there are some worthy candidates," I admitted. I considered making it a wedding gift to Sire Kay, but in truth, I want his attention on my estate, and his lady's, and I foresee he will be too busy to give Northwood the time and attention it needs. I could raise a yeoman, but that might be premature. I considered giving it to Sir Ferrando, but the man has a mercenary's eye when it comes to management. He could own an estate, but I wouldn't hire him to manage one. He's a good enough soldier, but he'd run Northwood into the ground and have a peasant's revolt on his hands.
"So who do you favour, Mage Lord?"
she asked, batting her eyelashes exaggeratedly and wiggling under the thin blanket. "I think I'm going to give it to Sir Runcel," I decided.
"Very good choice," she said at once.
"He's loyal. He looks to you as fondly as any of the peasantry for saving us at Boval. He's a knight with some steel to him, and he's been more or less running Brestal on Kay's behalf, and running it well," she added.
"I approve."
"Listen to you," I had chuckled. "You sound like you've been a noble for years. Remember when we rode through that gap for the first time last winter? Not even a year has passed, and you have grown so comfortable with your role, you're worried about the quality of wine at your castellan's wedding. I couldn't help but kiss her. She's so adorable when she blushes." Of course, that led to other things, and soon the night was just much too hot until we fell asleep, sated. That's why I was confused as I was awoken a few hours later, in the darkest of night, by someone essentially banging on the door of my mind.
"What is it? Who is it?"
I asked, even as I recognized Pentandra.
"Min, Get up, she commanded. You're needed.
I tried to recall which crisis I was addressing and where Pantandra was, and then I realized that she was still right here in Sevendor.
Penny, what is it? You're right across the hall. Why can't you just come over and knock? I didn't want to disturb Alia.
But it's fine to disturb me.
So, what is it?
I asked tiredly.
Look out your window,
she instructed me.
Huh? Just look out your window.
You'll see why I wanted you awake. If this is just an eclipse or a comet or something, I'm going to be pissed, I promised her as I pulled myself from my wife's embrace and stumbled over to the window. I rubbed my eyes and peered out into the darkness. Only it wasn't quite darkness. The moon was absent from the sky, but much of the veil was lightly aglow. The source of the light was coming from the top of Helm's Mount, over a mile away. It was a mage light, only not the sort that imperially trained magi create. All magic-using peoples have a variation of the mage light spell, even the nocturnal Gervan, and it's not an uncommon development of wild magic, unschooled talent. After all, the process is simple. Define an area of space, activate the atoms within, and energize the volume until the atoms in the gas are forced to produce light. But the way we go about that, the process and the shape of the spell, is very different. Most human magi do it in imperial fashion, because that's the way we learned it. But I'd seen a mage light like that before. It was the style of light used by the tree folk.
It looks like you have company, Penny said. Get dressed. It would be impolite to meet them with your dong hanging out.
Why not? They go around naked most of the time.
They have retractable phalli.
You'd just make them jealous, she teased. I'll get dressed, I said, ignoring her comment. If you're dressed already, then have someone run to the stables and have our mounts prepared. Giving Penny a chance to order someone around would keep her busy. She finds it irresistible. And get the other high magi up, my lazy apprentices included. Best we give them a proper greeting. There were 9 of us who ended up riding across the vale that night, but we weren't the only ones awakened by the light. As we passed through Sevendor village, there were several people out in the night's heat, staring up at the mysterious glow. I did my best to calm them, and the sudden appearance of a bunch of wizards was indeed reassuring. If the spellmonger was aware of it, there was little else they could do, they reasoned, and most returned to bed. Bannermore was waiting for us in the village, and nervously asked questions about the light as we rode towards Matten's Helm. He was almost as frightened as the peasantry, as he had never had any dealings with the tree folk, and was unaware of their magics. Once I explained that it was merely a mage light, but one made for Alka eyes, not human, explaining the odd color and brightness, he relaxed. After that, he was more curious than frightened, but that could have been because he was accompanied by war magi. Sarakim had brought his great bow, and seemed excited and enthusiastic about meeting the tree folk. Of course, Sarakim is excited and enthusiastic about breakfast, I'd learned. It seemed to be his nature. Riding across Sevendor during a hot summer's night was emboldening. My little land was rich and lush, the people well-fed and secure, and the distant mage light was strong enough to reflect off my snowstone keep and the magnificent white-bottomed pond as I looked back at it. I could smell the fresh mown hay, the richness of the newly ploughed fields, and could smell wild honeysuckle and husked maize conspiring to overcome, if even for a moment, the usual miasma of wood smoke and animal dung. I realized for the 100th time or so that I loved this little vale almost as much as I loved Minalion. By the time we arrived at the base of Matten's Helm, Master Olmeg and Zagor had both arrived before us. Master Olmeg was with 2 of the river folk, who were a-quiver with excitement. I'd seen how the little people reacted when in the presence of the Alka, and it was similar to how a zealot feels about a personal visitation from the deity he worships. Mage Lord, my green warden greeted me in his deep voice with a bow. I believe we are all here for the same purpose. The fair folk, sighed Zagor happily. He had been raised in the remote Alka-Alan outpost in the north end of Beauval Vale when it was discovered he had talent, and they had taught him bits and pieces of easy treefolk magic, which made him a powerful mage in his own right. They had also given him a witchstone, second in size only to the massive sphere I now possessed. I hadn't bothered to point it out to anyone, and didn't see a need to. But Zagor was the only acknowledged High Mage who had his stone without taking his oath from me. He was independent of the Order's discipline. If he was another sort of man, I might have been worried. As it was, I'd trust Zagor with just about anything. "It has been a long time," he said simply and a little sheepishly. "That looks like quite a steep climb," Planas said, concerned at the grade of the path. "It is," I agreed. "We'd best get started." We left the horses tied up at the bottom of the trail, and with Zagor eagerly leading the way, we ascended. It was quite a steep climb, but Planas and Pentandra kept up with no problem. It took almost an hour to wind our way up the rocky mount, but the way was well lit from the eerie mage light above, and the way was not difficult. The trail had existed for generations, perhaps since before Matten's Helm was known as such. It was a secluded and beautiful spot, a favourite for lovers, and from the summit you could see the two vales and beyond. When we made it to the top, we were not alone. At the far end of the helm, directly under the centre of the mage light, were three diminutive figures. The river folk pilgrims immediately began to twitter excitedly among themselves. Zagor was nearly as excited. I led the party across the meadow that covered the peak, my sphere dogging my steps behind my shoulder, until I came within speaking distance, when the most fascinating thing happened. The tree folk got taller and less naked. There were three females I saw, but just as I came close enough to read their faces, their entire bodies seemed to grow and stretch, and then sprouted clothes. When the enchantment was done, all three Alka women appeared as breathtakingly beautiful human women. Human, mostly. I suppose it was the Alka Alon's interpretation of humanity, for despite the size and shape and perfectly formed features, their new shapes retained an alien quality that was, somehow, still essentially treefolk in presentation. The ears, for example, weren't shaped the way human ears were, being slightly too large and too angular. They were taller than most women, nearly 6 feet tall. Their facial features were sharp, making Penny's well-defined cheekbones look round in comparison. Their eyes were thickly lashed and beautiful, somewhat slanted and almond-shaped, their lips thin yet softly rounded. The clothes they had conjured were just as beautiful as their bearers. Only the fabric seemed richer than any I'd seen in Castabriel, gowns of flowing silken cloth, the exact colour and lustre of a white rose petal. They were embellished with decorations of the most elegant simplicity, abstract lines resembling climbing vines or trees or flowers. Their green hair was gone, their pale, almost human complexions complemented by a fastidiously coiffed mane of golden or silver hair. They looked like three goddesses, lost from some errant heaven, only they seemed cleaner, somehow, than a human divinity would appear. "Mage Lord Minilan of Sevendor," the beautiful golden-haired woman said in flawless Narasi, "the Alka Alon begged the pleasure of your audience." I bowed as deeply as I possibly could. I was gratified everyone else did the same, except the river folk, who were prostrate on their faces in awe. "The pleasure is ours, ladies," I said as I rose. "Yet your raiment." The leader looked down at her new body.
"An enchantment designed to assist in negotiations," she explained.
"An illusion?" asked Penny, who just couldn't help herself.
"Nay, Lady Pentandra,"
the Alka woman said formally. Her voice was like a bass pipe. "A transgenic enchantment. This is as we would be if we held a humani essence instead of an Alka."
"That's amazing,"
Penny declared,
"and that would explain a lot of confusion about your race in our oldest texts. The enchantment was first wrought long ago, when we first gifted your people with Perwin, to facilitate communication and understanding. I can only assume that my ancestors grew weary of always looking up when speaking to a humani. I assure you, the body is quite as real as your own."
She held out both hands and declined her head slightly. I wouldn't classify it so much as a bow as a failed nod.
"I am Verne. This,"
she said, gesturing to the woman on her left, whose hair was a lighter shade of gold than hers,
"is Felowin,
And I believe you know Ithalia, she said, gesturing to the woman on her right. Her hair was silver, but not in the same way a human's hair was. I started. Lady Ithalia, from Alsha. She favoured me with a smile that would have made Alia jealous.
When the opportunity arose to fulfil this delegation,
she explained in a voice like a soft wooden flute,
it was thought my inclusion would find your favour after our previous encounter.
Knowing that the beautiful, humanish woman in front of me was actually no more than 4 feet tall and had green hair didn't diminish the experience. It does indeed, I assured her. But to what do we owe the pleasure of the company of the fair folk? I asked, using the term Zagor had used. The common threat of the abomination and his minions is a danger to us all, Varen continued. Many of our kindred favour re-establishing old alliances between our people. In token of this, we wish to form a permanent embassy to you, Mage Lord, to facilitate communication and understanding.
I am amenable to this, I nodded, thinking of all the incredible possibilities. Yet would not King Rad be the one to whom this embassy is addressed?
The Homani ruler may be useful, but he has no power to stop Sherul,
Followen said, speaking for the first time. Her voice was human, and sounded like a brass horn.
Without him, the lands of both our peoples will be overrun by Gavani, Pentandra pointed out. Unless the Alka'alon have thousands willing to take up arms, it will be Humani warriors who oppose them on the field. Sherul is their leader, and no war will be won until he is destroyed. But until then, we must contend with their legions. And to do that, we will need the organization and resources of the kingdom, and of the king.
That is understood, Varen nodded. That is why we graced his coronation as we did. But we have a poor history. Dealing with the warrior princes of your people, Mage Lord. When they overran the Majocracy, we attempted to negotiate with them. They responded poorly, she said, a tone in her beautiful voice that was both sorrowful and pissed. Since then we have withdrawn behind our veils and largely left you to your own affairs, as we tend to ours. Now that we have a common foe, we hope that a more civilized discussion may be had with the magi of your lands, as was of old.
We ask that you act as our intermediary with King Rad, Followen said. Somehow I got the feeling she was the most critical of us and this effort. You understand the thinking of a Humani warrior prince better than we. If we must, we will visit his court in person, but our intent is to advise Humani magi, not appease the conceits of a Humani king.
To that end, we request that we be given leave to make our embassy here, Lady Ithalia said, indicating the peak of the mount.
Of old, this was an outpost of one of our houses, and some subtle magics from that time persist.
That was news to me. I knew of the stone folk connection to the site, but wasn't aware of any Alka'alon settlement.
We wish to make it a hostel close by, to give you counsel and aid as we can.
To share our understanding of the nature of magic, added Followen.
To guide you in your efforts against the abomination,
finished Varen.
Will you grant us this embassy, Mage Lord?
Did they think I'd say no?
I grant you this mount as your embassy, I agreed. It shall be forbidden to my people save at your bidding. What do you need from me and my land? I asked, trying not to sound fawning.
Little enough, Mage Lord, said Ithalia. We can provide most of what we shall need. But we ask leave to build shelters, after the style of our kind, so that we may dwell here in comfort.
Build whatever you wish, I agreed. If you have need of anything, merely ask.
As to that,
Varen said, with a hint more deliberation,
would you be willing to allow us to build our hostel of snowstone?
I shrugged. Take all you need. I've got a mountain of it. In fact, I'm thinking of expanding the castle, but we'll have plenty of time to discuss that.
Welcome to Sevendor, I said, with a deep, contented sigh. Make yourself at home.
All three of the women smiled now and turned toward each other. Raising their arms, they began singing, and it put to shame every note any human being ever uttered.
The song spell they wove was foreign, exotic, rich and potent, and it seemed to shimmer the air around them as they sang. From the space between them, for the first time, I noticed a tree, a mere sapling, with silver bark and golden leaves. It was about 2 feet tall, and it glowed with a preternatural light. The alka sang until the tree reached 6 feet in height. It sprouted branches and limbs as it grew, and new leaves sprung out in abundance. When they ended their song, it seemed to sparkle to outshine the stars. "A token of our alliance," Varen said, "a rare tree from our homeland, and once the symbol of a great house of our kindred. Centuries before Humani was born from the void, it grew wild throughout this region, but the Gavani and the Iron Folk sought to fell every tree in their wars against us." Zagor looked enchanted, and Olmeg looked like he was going to wet himself. I was almost as impressed. The Alka Alon love trees the way river folk love a good meal. According to legend, their enchanted forests were filled with all sorts of rare and exotic trees, some of which could be crafted into weapons and tools of great power. Others could cure illness, or reduce aging, or ease suffering, or even more esoteric things. There was even recorded in some histories from the Majocracy that humanity's gift of 1,000 different Impotasta trees had convinced the Alka Alon to give us Perwin to settle. So this was no mere decorative shrub. To the Alka Alon, trees were significant. This tree seemed to radiate magic like heat from an oven. The Alka ladies looked pleased with themselves. They turned to me as one and bowed gracefully.
"We are pleased, Mage Lord," Varen said in her deep, compelling voice. "From time to time, we may descend the mount to have conversation with you, or walk in meditation in your beautiful vale."
"We will count such a visit a blessing," I agreed. "May this be the beginning of a long and helpful alliance." After that, we all had to study this wondrous tree, meet our new neighbors, and speak of future plans. Varen asked my permission to summon a builder of the stone folk to do the construction of the hostel. I thought that was a magnificent idea, and I secretly hoped I could find more information on the legendary lost city, and maybe get a quote on upgrading my castle. Olmeg wanted to know about the tree's growth. Penny and Planus were curious as to its magical properties, and Sarakim, interestingly enough, asked about its history. He's kind of a flamboyant fop, but the War Mage also hid a keen intelligence under his mannerisms.
"So what do you think all of this means?"
Pentandra asked me, mind to mind. "It means my magical fair will be outrageously popular if we can get these ladies down the hill to visit," I said, after considering. I knew that's not what Penny wanted my opinion on, but that's what I was thinking about at the time.
"No, I mean, why do you think they suddenly want an alliance with us so badly that they're willing to send you 3 attractive fake maidens and a pretty tree? Must you question everything?" I lamented. "That's what the Order pays me for," she agreed. "I'm not forswearing their gifts and their counsel. Erentia knows we need it, but I have to question their motives too."
"We have a common enemy, remember?" I reminded her.
"I haven't forgotten. Neither have they. That's what makes me suspicious."
"Or maybe you're jealous of how incredibly beautiful they are."
"Exactly, Min," she agreed. "They've taken human form. There are all sorts of accounts of them doing this back in the ancient days. Sometimes it was helpful, but a lot of times it led to problems, particularly when female Alka were involved. Remember the tale of the Witch of Kaivahan?"
"No," I said patiently, "but the pretty ladies want to help us, and I'm not the kind of man who just loses control at the sight of a shapely ear."
"Yes, actually, you are," she observed. "This is why I brought it to your attention in the first place."
I couldn't really argue with that, and maybe she had a point. But I had beautiful, enchanted tree folk living next door to the castle now, and they wanted to ply me with gifts. It would take an awful lot of compelling reasons for me to worry about that with everything else that was going on.
"I think you're paranoid," I told her, "but I'll keep an eye on them. Just..."
"What?"
"Just don't mention this to my wife. She only thinks of tree folk as cute, quaint little creatures of folklore. If she knew what they looked like now, somehow I don't think she'd be very enthusiastic about the new girls in the village."